Welcome to the Belfast Men's Health Group podcast with Dr. Alan Curley, an award-winning mindset therapist and author. Today, Alan's going to talk about his new book, Playing the Game of Your Life. But before that, we're going to hear a wee bit about who is Alan, a wee bit about his background, a wee bit about his influences, and maybe, Alan, how would you describe yourself?
Okay, well, first of all, thanks for inviting me. It's a real honour, and these are quite new that I look forward to, and hopefully some of what I say might help someone else. So I currently lecture at the University in Glasgow. I lecture on mental health and addictions, but I still work in the field in terms of helping clients, real people, overcome addiction, manage stress or manage their states. And I also work in sports psychology, so half my time is spent with clients who are trying to improve their sporting performance. Mm-hmm. And the link between all of these people really is, Paul, that they're all people who are trying to perform better or perform to their best or overcome challenging situations which are stopping them mm-hmm. being their best or performing to the level they could, whether that's at work or whether it's in life.
Yes.
My own background, I suppose, is, again, a lot of your listeners, is that I grew up in a council estate in a town outside Glasgow. Mm-hmm. But again, I always think nowadays when people hear council estate, they have this kind of dark, grim idea of it. And it wasn't, in those days, it wasn't unemployed. You know, there wasn't a lot of unemployment. It was people who were working class, real working families. And it was a real kind of family and friends estate. I was one of four brothers and sisters. So there was always noise and conflict and laughter and parties and people in your house or you were in other people's houses. And it was a real family and friends kind of a place. People told stories, sang songs. Mm-hmm. And I always liken it a bit like that. You know that Madness song, mm-hmm. Our House?
Yep.
Or a house in our street. It was like that kind of street. Great place to grow up. And that's probably where it triggered my curiosity and intrigue into different characters, different people in their characters, the different stories they tell, the different angles they take on different stories. You know, you'd hear four people telling the same story different ways. Mm-hmm. And ultimately how people ultimately behaved and the mindset they had on life and how to cope, you know. I get intrigued by people. Mm-hmm. And then I think my dad had a big influence because, see, around about that age, kind of when I was about 14, that age when my dad recognised I was good at school, but a lot of my friends from the estate, you know, they were at that age where they didn't really like school. They couldn't wait till they left. They wanted to leave and become like men, you know, get jobs, work, earn money.
Yeah.
And my dad kind of, I think, knew that I had a little bit more about me academically. Mm-hmm. So he was a carpet fitter. So he decided he was going to take me and my brother. We had to go every school holiday and work with him fitting carpets. And I have to say, my brother was always really practically minded. So he was great at it. He loved it. Mm-hmm. But my dad, but I hated it. You know, crawling about cold, yeah. damp houses,
yeah.
on floorboards, dust everywhere, uh-huh. and, you know, kind of humping carpets up 4 and 5 story tenement buildings. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't good at it. And it's something, you know, I always say to people later on, is see, no matter what your job is, see being good at it, what a difference it makes. See when you know you go in every day and you're not good at something. And mm-hmm. That really eats away. So the time dragged every day for me. I hated it. And I think it was maybe a bit of genius on my dad's part. He realised probably that this would be the case. So then you imagine I return back to school after the holidays and I'm sitting in these warm classes with all my friends, reading and writing, yes. talking and listening, sharing ideas and theories in English and science. And I loved it and I was good at it. It came quite natural to me to read and write and talk and listen and mm-hmm. enjoy it. So I thought, well, this would be a better job than carpet fitting, you know, yeah. sitting about all day reading, talking to people, yes. sharing ideas in a nice warm room with as much tea and coffee as I wanted yeah. to drink. yeah. And I think that's where I realised that I was never going to be a practical man or a tradesman, you know.
Yes, yes.
And that's how it came about. So then I was lucky enough, I stuck in at school because of that, you know, when you've seen the other side, you kind of then, well, for me, I appreciate being good academically. What I kind of better or easier life for me that would be, not for everyone, but for me. Mm-hmm. Ended up doing well at school, going to Glasgow University, and then ultimately doing a PhD at Imperial College in London and then in Oxford University in England, you know. Mm-hmm. And then, if you don't mind, I just carry on. So that carried on that love of people, because what happened now was, you know, I started transferring the social states. I don't mean that in a kind of big way. I just meant that going from a council estate to then Glasgow Uni was a jump up in terms of the people I was then spending a lot of time with. To then go for Glasgow Uni to Imperial in London, it was another step up to the kind of level of class in terms of wealth and upbringing that the other students have had versus me. And then finally finishing my studies at Oxford.
Yes.
It was around people that I got on really well with and had great friends and all of these, but they had different stories and different upbringings and different experiences and other ends of the spectrum from the people that I spent my early life with.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give an example of that. It's like most of my friends, you know, in my council state I grew up with, who are still great friends of mine, you know, dads were like painter and decorators, tradesmen, you know.
Yes.
When I was at Oxford, one of my mates there, Andy Porter, his dad was Sir George Porter. He'd won the Nobel Prize for chemistry because he invented chemiluminescence lighting. You know,
brilliant.
That was the difference in the types of people. And all equally great. I'm not judging them. They just had different stories, different experiences. And that never left. And then I felt like I became a little bit of a chameleon. You know, that way where I could almost change how I could speak or talk, or mindset, because I'd been in all these different people's company, and I'd asked them loads of questions about their stories, how they process the world, you know, how their experiences have shaped how they behave, how they think. And then just to finish sort of, then I would sometimes come back home, you know, and back to the council estate. Mum, Dad still lived there, and I would start to see as I got older some of the demise of the guys I grew up with, you know, guys who you looked at and when they were long, they were good looking, or they were stylish, or they were tough and hard, or they were great footballers, and you just wanted to be like them, you know, had those skills. And then I started to see in my 20s, you know, late 20s, that some of these guys now were drinking, you know, drug taking, unemployed, and seeing that potential that, you know, I wish I had been like someone myself, and as I was growing in potential in a way, because of my experiences, they were getting further away from their potential, and that then led me to want to spend a life kind of studying what are the traits that make us reach a potential and what are the things that can really hinder us, so that hopefully maybe one day I could work with people and help maybe level up a little bit, you know, the idea of give people a chance to kind of know the science behind, the real science that you can really use in the real world about what can help people use their traits, no matter where they're from, to get as far on in life as their potential, you know. And I'll give you one example. It's like Boris Johnson to me, right? He's the opposite. Like I see a guy like Boris, I've never met him, but you see him and you think he seems a bit of that blubbering idiot. Like kind of guy you think would ever hire him. But you know, he's had a very privileged background and he's running the country, you know, and he's getting away with mistake after mistake, you know, and you think that's a skill. So what I mean is, if he was brought on my council estate, he would be the town, he would be the state idiot, probably. You know, doing manual labour. You know, that's the difference. And the environments, the upbringing, the coaches, the role models and advantages. And that's been a real curiosity from all my life, you know.
And then sort of moving on into your work in UC Main Solutions. What's that all about, Alan?
Well, as I said, we were an addiction centre, you know, many years ago, working in a council area, helping kind of, again, real people with real addictions, trying to overcome them. And what I learned in the early days was, you know, the drinking and the drug taking wasn't really the problem. It was the either not coping well with things that life had thrown at them, or sometimes I think, you know, a concept I've spoken to you before, Paul, about sometimes what I call less than happiness. Guys that got a certain level of life where they weren't depressed as such, but I think in their heart they knew that they could have been doing and should have been doing more with themselves, with their lives, and then that not doing it, you know, doing a job that maybe they felt they could have done more than that, or, you know, having a family set up that they felt they could have done more with themselves, with their life, that began to eat away at them. And so they would then turn to things like drink and drugs to kind of almost escape or distract. And so I realised it was working around people's emotions, how they coped, how they performed with challenges in life. That if we could get to the heart of that, then we might be able to then stop them requiring alcohol, drugs, you know, gambling, all the other stuff that were just really self-medicating for either trying to become happier or trying to distract, you know. And that's what we do. We use a lot of CBT models, what are called the behavioural therapy models, which is a nice holistic model. It's that way that you appreciate that it's how people think then impacts and influences how they speak, and how they speak and think influences how they feel, then how they feel influences how they behave, and then how they behave influences how the other people around them begin to behave and interact with them. And so CBT looks at all of those influences and says, well, if you really want to move forward in life, if you want to try and improve, become happier, more successful, perform better, whatever that is, you know, work in life, then you need to kind of look at how do you kind of trigger changes in all of these aspects, this kind of holistic look at yourself. Mm-hmm. And then we brought an idea of mind fitness. So it was one that worked with us when most of our clients about 20 years ago were male in the addictions world. And then we found that men didn't want to talk about their mental health. So, you know, there still is that stigma around saying, I don't feel I'm doing as well as I can, or I'm struggling to cope with my family and my job and, you know, still being a man, or, you know, my social activities. Mm-hmm. But we noticed that if you think that our centre is like therapy rooms, but in the middle of it is a big gym. We have boxing rings and we do classes and stuff. So it's like a gym, and the rooms around the gym are like therapy rooms. Mm-hmm. In the early days, what happened was when we put the guys together in a group setting for a bit of physical activity work, we noticed once they got together, they would all open up very quickly. You know, they'd say things like, as soon as they seen the ring or the treadmills, you know, I'm not as fit as I used to be. They'd open up and share that with you. I'm not physically as fit as I used to be because I stopped playing football or golf or whatever. I was fitter when I was younger, and then, you know, I've had a few problems. I've not been to the gym. So they'd open up. Then they would say things like, but I'm determined I'm going to put some time and effort into this gym, and I'm going to try and get fitter again. So I suppose my point there is, they understood physical fitness as a concept that your fitness levels change depending on what's life's thrown at you. Mm-hmm. You know, if life's thrown other things that are draining you of energy. Mm-hmm. If you've not invested a lot of time and energy into your own fitness levels, then they slip. You know, if you've not ran for a year, mm-hmm. there's no way you think you can put your shorts on and go out running, and then you'll run the same speed and the same distance as you were doing a year ago when you were doing it every day or something. You know?
Perfect. Absolutely.
And so we started to say, well, why don't we talk about mindfulness rather than mental health? Because I always think, this is just my opinion, but mm-hmm. when you say to people mental health issues, it feels like you've got a disease or something wrong with you. Mm-hmm. And it's not, you wouldn't say because someone can't run 100 metres in 10 seconds like Usain Bolt, you wouldn't say, well, he's physically diseased.
Yeah.
You know, you would say that guy's just not as fit, or, you know, his potential isn't there as much. Mm-hmm. So mind fitness is the idea that your mental fitness is the energy, how you can perform with your mind in terms of cope with things. Mm-hmm. But it goes up and down depending on what life's throwing at you. So if I've got a mother who's now in a care home and I'm having to go and visit her after work every day, I won't have the same mental fitness because I've now got something else which is taking energy from me. It's draining me. Mm-hmm. I have to do that. I didn't have to do last year. If I've not been spending a lot of time investing in my own mental fitness, so if I've not been to classes, reading, interacting with people, socialising, doing things that give me some energy back, mm-hmm. then my fitness levels will go down. Mm-hmm. And so mind fitness, like the body, the brain's the same, isn't it? If you mm-hmm. if you work at it, the muscle gets stronger, gets bigger, and it can do more.
Yeah.
And so now we talk about mind fitness. So the guys come in and they're like, oh, my mental fitness has been down a bit this week. Because they know then that, well, let's work at it and get your fitness levels back up, rather than it's an irreversible thing that's now you've got something wrong with you and you're less up to everybody else.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. our fitness levels got down, Paul.
Yeah, and I think we talked briefly about limitations. Can you expand on that, Alan? I know I've got another couple of questions, but that limitations, how that affects us, particularly men?
Yeah, I think we all have to appreciate, I think it's about working to your potential best.
Yeah.
And I always say that to people, and everyone's potential is different. Mm-hmm. Although what I used to use is, our potential for happiness is all the same. We just need to find out what makes us happy.
Yeah.
What I said earlier on, find the things you're good at. You know, I generally have friends that are car mechanics. One guy's a binman, but they're good at what they do and they love it. And they love it partly because they know when they go in every day that people say, he's good at that, you know. And that makes us something, you know, finding what we love, finding what our potential is, and spending more time doing the things where your potential is. Mm-hmm. In terms of limits, there is a limit. And I'll tell you a story to sum that up. It was one of my first painful experiences where I was doing sports psychology. So I'll give you a wee bit of background, hopefully quickly. Is mm-hmm. my first ever sports client was a local boxer. He was a local postman, and he was a retired professional boxer. And he came to me and he said, you know, around addiction stuff. But he said, you know, funnily enough, I've been offered, it was a British title fight, and the opponent had called off at the last minute. And the other guy had organised this big show. It was going to be on Sky Sports, and they were hunting around it. In the boxing world, what happens is, you know, the board has to license a fight, so the other person has to be a professional boxer.
Yes.
And they have to be the same weight, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they were busy phoning all these other guys in Britain, and everyone was like, oh, taking a fight with 2 days to go, a couple of days to go in advance. You know, nobody wants to get beat. And so, but he had retired, say, 6 months before it, right? And he was a local postman.
Uh-huh.
So eventually they went down the list, and they'd phoned him up and said, look, we've seen here your professional license is still valid, because I think it takes a year to expire or something. You know, if you've not boxed for a year, you're blind. And we've got this fight that could be called off, nobody else will take it, and we'll offer you £10,000, and it's on Sky's vote, right? So, I mean, he's a postman, right?
Yes,
and
yes.
And he said at the time, he's like, I thought, well, I'll help a little bit of my mortgage. And so he'd been coming to me, right, and said, I've got this, he said, I'm really worried. I said, I've just taken it, I need the money. You know, the money's good for me. He says, but, you know, I've got this opponent, and trying to beat him is difficult. And we've been working on beating an addiction, you know, like, you know, and take them through the program.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I said, well, what? He said, is there anything we can do for sports? He said, well, I'll use some of the concepts, I'll translate it into sport and stuff. And we did that. And anyway, so he goes in and he wins, becomes British champion.
Wow.
And then he beats the guy, knocks the guy down the first round. Right.
Brilliant.
So then Sky Sports were interviewing him, and he didn't have the money to pay me at the time. But I said to him, look, you know, I'll do it, but if you get interviewed, just say my name, you know, that was the payment. So anyway, he won. Yeah. And then they were all at Jim Warren, all the commentators were saying it's a one-off, it's one of these. And they get in like Boxing Monthly magazine. It was like the biggest upset of the year and all that. Local boxer becoming British champion. So they said they could never do it again. And so then they paid him even more money to do a rematch.
Yeah.
Because the other guy had lost his British title.
Yeah.
So he came back and he said, look, they've offered me more money to fight again. I'm just going to do it. He's just thinking, trying to loan my mortgage here, you know.
Of course.
And we worked again, and then Sky Sports came out and done like a documentary on his, you know, like it was in part of Sky Sports.
Yes.
And then he won it again. He won again, and they were just like, so my point with limits is, see, at this point, Paul, I thought this sporting program that could make anybody beat any opponent, you know.
Yes, yes.
And then, because he was British champion, he got offered another fight, and it was with a boxer called Kell Brook, who's English. And he was a world champion, you know, and he's fought in Vegas. So anyway, so the next fight is Kell Brook. And so we're doing this thing, thinking, you know, we're unstoppable. And he walks out and gets knocked out in round one, you know, by Kell Brook, who went on to become a world champion. And that's what I learned. The painful thing is, it's limits. I can't make somebody become a world champion.
Yeah.
What you can only do is help them to be their best, their potential best that they are. And a bit like, you know, you have the greatest mindset in the world, Paul, but you can't have it against Mike Tyson and knock him out. Even with a mindset, you know.
Yeah.
And I learned that day, and then my work changed a little bit. It was about making sure people knew about their limitations, but still had aspirations and goals.
Of course.
Difference between just saying, oh, I can't do that, and saying, well, you can do it to your best. Mm-hmm. And the buzz of knowing you've been as good as got to your best, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And when I work with sports people, and a lot of football managers will tell you that when they interview, but I remember speaking to Alex Ferguson, he said when he used to, at Man United, when he went around scouting, or people told him about potential young talent, he said, I would often interview them and I would accept them more on their interview than when I watched them play football, because I was looking for the attitude. I was looking for somebody who was willing to push themselves to their best.
Yeah.
So he says something like Paul Scholes wasn't the naturally most gifted player.
Mm-hmm.
But he said, when I spoke to him, I just knew this boy would listen and do everything to become the best they could. Whereas I remember him saying the best player he ever seen young was, I think it was Joe Cole, a guy called Joe Cole. Mm-hmm. And he said, really, really talented. But when I spoke to him, he just didn't have quite the attitude I was looking for Man United. And he said, never signed him, you know.
Yeah.
And Joe Cole never went on and done anywhere near what Paul Scholes did.
Yeah, that's true. Yep. We could talk all day, but we need to press on for the next question.
Yes,
and the next question is in the introduction we talked about you're an author. You have a book out. It's Playing the Game of Your Life. Tell us briefly a wee bit about that.
Yep. So Playing the Game of Your Life. I wanted to write a story which would engage men predominantly. You know, so the kind of guys who would never pick up a book. So
yes.
I wanted a story, but I wanted a story that could have meaning in it. I wanted like a kind of change program. I wanted them, men that would never come my centre or any centre and try and do self-help and self-change. You know, the kind of guys maybe the stigma wouldn't do it. So mm-hmm. I thought, I want a story, but within the story there is a change, a 12-week change programme with each chapter's got a technique that we use in CBT. If people are thinking they would like to improve themselves or make themselves happier or just move forward in whatever aspect of life. So the story, it follows five young footballers, and I picked football because I thought it's a good working class theme, mm-hmm. you know. Five young footballers who are wanting to make it to the Premiership, play in the Premiership, play at that top level. Mm-hmm. And they're all very good. And before then, they make it, there's a final 12-week camp by the FA. And they go to this 12-week camp. They run it every year, and all the best players in England go, young players. They're all about 16, 18. And this is the first year where they have to sit in a sports psychology class. So normally they're doing like strength and conditioning, nutrition, you know, gym work, football skills, football strategies, different classes. But this year they have to sit in a sports psychology class. And it comes down to what I always say to my clients, too, is that for 12 weeks they have to start to think about their thinking. How do they think? How do they cope and set up their mind before and after games for challenges on and off the pitch, how they cope and deal with those? And that's what it falls. So it falls the five of them through that. And then in the final week, the scouts over there watching them play football and choose who they think is good enough to go on and play at a Premiership level. Mm-hmm. And so each chapter is a theme of one of the traits that, through science and psychology, we know it helps people to reach their potential if they can nurture these traits. So things like confidence, self-belief, focus, motivation, commitment, you know, attitude, yes, ambition, you know, all that mm-hmm, stuff. Mm-hmm. And it takes you through a wee bit of the theory, you know, what are the definitions of each of these things? So what's attitude actually mean? How can you observe it and measure it in someone? And then a little bit about where does it come from? So, you know, the book looks at, you know, Where does your ambition levels come from? Where, if you're a certain level of ambition, where did you get it from? And then finally, a technique for improving. If you decide that I think I should be more ambitious or more confident or try and get more motivated, mm-hmm. how a technique for doing that. And then at the end, not to be a spoiler, but it takes you through how the five boys ended up doing in the game. Okay. Who was successful, who made it, who didn't.
Yeah.
And it's kind of based on the traits that you see coming out in them. And their desire to try and keep improving or not mm-hmm. those traits. And it comes from, probably don't mean, it comes from, I once done work in a school, and it's a behavioural school, so it's, you know, classically they've called a school for bad boys, but they don't say that anymore. But, you know,
yeah,
boys that would be there, and residential schools, they would mm-hmm. kick to other schools, or, you know, from an upbringing, they just can't stay in their environment. And I remember the PE teacher years ago when I worked there, because I talked on addictions to the young boys, you know, telling me that he said, I've seen some of the greatest young talent here, Alan. You know, our football team's brilliant. All of these boys are not academic, but some of them are excellent footballers. But the football team has been kept out of every league, because whenever we go, if somebody winds them up, they want to stab them or fight them, or at halftime, they're all starting to open cans of cider and all that. You know, they're 14 years old. He says, so we're knocked out of every league. And he says, but what's even sadder is I've worked here for 15 years, he says, and I've seen some of the best young talent. I've seen not one of these boys has ever made it to a professional footballer, even at the lowest ranks of professional. He says, because the moment they get the chance and some of them given it, they just don't have all the other traits that allow them to be able to make it in a professional team. And that always stuck with me, and that's where the book came from. Mm-hmm. What are the traits that can either make a young man reach his potential and play his best game?
Yeah.
Or not. And that's ultimately the book's about, you know.
And where can we get the book? Where can we find it?
It's available in all good bookshops, so anything from Amazon to Waterstones and stuff like that. I'm not saying there'll be copies of every Waterstones out there, but it's all on the in bookshops list. So Barnes & Noble, Amazon, Waterstones. If they don't have it, they can order it in, because it's on their list of approved books. So it's worth a read. You know, I think I told you, Paul, the biggest compliment I ever got was one of the guys I know. He said he left school at 15, dyslexic, no qualifications. He said, I've never read a book in my life. This is the first book I've ever read. Mm-hmm. And it's because it is a story ultimately about young guys trying to become professional footballers. Like, it was in the heart of all of us, and watching their journey and the traits that they need. Or they should be nurturing if they want to get there.
Mm-hmm. Right. I guess then, how do you look after your own health then? How do you stay mentally fit?
I think over the years, you know, earlier in my early years when I drank too much and ate too much, it was very much do as I say, not as I do. But as I've got older and the body doesn't play game as much, I try and stick to the models I use. So things that I love to run now, you know, just get out and run. And gone are the days of playing a lot of sports. I worry too much about injury, I think, as I've got older. So I like running, just getting out there. I think it's mental and physical for me. I just put my music on and go out running, you know. And I stop when I'm getting tired and I don't need to get certain times or distances. I love playing music. So for me, running's that kind of physical escape, you know, just I love playing music. And that's that kind of emotional side for me. You know, a lot of the music I play is from my youth, you know, and takes me back to some lovely memories and emotions. So that's kind of my emotional side. I still love going to live events, like sporting events, theatre, concerts. And that's that kind of social thing. I love going to, you know, events where there's just loads of people who get something in common and there's a real kind of buzz in the air. And I still love socialising with my friends and family, again, from people I grew up with, people I went to uni with. And in fact, I still love reading and TEDx talks. I'm a great believer in you should still always try and educate yourself, learn more, and try and maybe get more mindsets or viewpoints that might make you change some of your ideas. And at the end, I feel I've got a good balance. I'm currently at a good balance, good place in my life when I've got that kind of mental, emotional, physical, and social thing. So running, music, live events, spending time with family and friends, and reading, and I like TEDx talks or autobiographies, or, you know, listening to people that somebody's done something that you think that's really inspirational. I want to hear how they did it, what their mindset is, you know.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And I guess now we've come to our final question. Now it's a more of a sort of lighthearted dream job. It sounds like you're in your dream job anyway, Alan, but you have to step outside it to tell me what your dream job would be. Or if I give you £1 million, what would you do?
First of all, dream job, I think, I'd love to be a professional boxer, you know, that real macho thing there. But having worked with quite a few of them now, it's the toughest, loneliest job in the world. So I think when I work with them and I hear them, what they have to do, it's not that. But so probably the NBA, if it wasn't professional boxer, it'd be like a professional footballer, like a George Best, you know, but one of those kind of really famous kind of ones that live in the lifestyle. Or probably would be more as football manager. I think I was never really good at football, and I wasn't that sporty, Paul, if I was there was a problem with academia when I was young. But I think seeing now, as I've had to study, like, people being successful, the mindsets of success, the traits that get you to your potential. Now I'm at an age where I feel I know the theory. I would have loved to have went back and coached myself or coached others, and then like either helped them become football players or became a football manager, you know, like Alex Ferguson, where you can try and smile people that really have the talent you don't have, but you have the knowledge and the vision of what will make a great team and a great player, you know. So probably football player or football manager. And that links into, you know, now I know how to play the game, I just don't have the skill to go on the pitch.
And I see you weren't going into sort of the middle range, or you're going to the top end, George Best and Alex Ferguson, you know.
You're going to do it, be ambitious.
That's it. Brilliant. Okay, we've come to the end of our podcast. Can I say thanks very much? And literally, I could have sat here and listened to you all day. That was absolutely fantastic, and thank you.
Thank you very much, Paul, and thank you to everyone listening.
Thanks very much.